Good morning and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gotcher.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/CFLAR, and on Twitter at CFLAR. Big cats.
And we're on YouTube as well, correct?
We are on YouTube.
We always have interesting videos out there, so if you're looking for something to see interesting, you got to go check out the YouTube video too.
You can find that at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
So I found out something interesting when I was doing some research this week. I thought you might find it interesting. I was looking up the definition for capstone species.
Oh, what'd you find?
Well, interestingly enough, when I put it into Wikipedia, the question was there, but there was also the note that no one had answered that question as yet. There is no definition of capstone species in Wikipedia.
At least the truth hasn't been determined by the masses yet, but we've certainly heard the term before.
Right. Well, and I had looked it up based on a conversation you and I had had earlier in the week. So clearly I had some idea of what it was already. I wanted to see what was available on the internet as far as a definition, and I was kind of surprised to find that there was no clear definition, at least not there. I'm sure there's other places I could have dug to find it.
That is interesting, though, especially since capstone species get a lot of attention in the conservation world.
Right, and one of the other things I started to do was to look at some of the other sites like the World Wildlife Fund and look at some of the things they talk about. And clearly, capstone species are a big deal for funds such as that for raising money and awareness about conservation.
Absolutely. Especially when it comes to raising money, there have to be a number of species that are going to be marketable and of interest to make people want to conserve.
Sure. And so maybe at this point, we should probably make a quick definition of what, at least our definition, the CIFAR, Simba and Asla definition of capstone species.
Well, I'm sure it's not going to be too far off, but a capstone species is really a species that is endangered in some way, shape, or form, but also has a certain general public appeal that it can be used as a representative for all the endangered species, including the ones that aren't necessarily as marketable.
Well, and of course, the big point there is it's like calling them an ambassador for all the other species that are involved with that particular capstone species.
I like that idea, these species as ambassadors.
Sure. They may not have chosen it, but I guess we get to choose them as their ambassador.
Indeed, since we're the species that's going to have to do the conserving.
Good point. But I also wanted to bring up some interesting facts I found out on the World Wildlife Fund site. I specifically looked up tiger, and there are 6 different types of tiger or families in the family of tigers. There's 6 different types of tigers. And I know there's the Sumatran, the Indo-Chinese tiger, the Southern Chinese tiger, and the Bengal tiger that we're all aware of. And the remaining ones are a little different because we've always heard them called the Siberian tiger, but there's apparently another name, the, how do you say it?
The Amur tiger, Amur Highland.
The Amur tiger. Not Amur, not the love tiger, but Amur tiger. But that apparently is another name for the Siberian tiger, which is interesting in itself, as there's some controversy as to why they have different names by different people.
It's a good question. I think that it becomes a question of who is doing the research and what name it's actually given, where the source of that research comes.
And that makes sense. And of course, the 6th tiger species is the Malayan tiger.
Yes, and the Malayan tiger is a really interesting story. As recently as probably about, 7 years ago, there really wasn't a Malayan tiger that was in the popular consciousness. It was commonly thought that there were only 5 subspecies of tiger. Take out the Malayan. The Malayan tiger really has kind of come about as the 6th subspecies, and of course, this has to undergo a certain amount of scientific scrutiny and scientific genetic testing and whatnot, but fundamentally, it is a now considered another subspecies of tiger, and although we've gone up by subspecies, that has not really increased the total number of tigers that are actually around in the world.
Well, that's part of the thing that's so frightening, is that the website cited their only remaining 3,200 tigers in their natural habitats. Basically, there's only 3,200 tigers left in the wild, and that's of all the species together, all the subspecies together.
That's right. Of those, over half, I believe, are considered to be Bengal tigers.
So curiosity-wise, because you mentioned the Malayan tiger is the newest one, did one of the other species get split out into another subspecies, or was there some kind of discovery of a different subspecies that we just weren't aware of?
I think it would be really challenging to actually know whether or not another subspecies of tiger just appeared out of nowhere. The Malayan tiger, obviously being a part of Malaysia, is a tiger that is going to be very elusive. It's going to naturally be rare because it is its own subspecies and it's a relatively new subspecies. I don't believe that there are really that many features that would make a Malayan tiger look or act very much differently from most of the other tiger subspecies. There are certainly some differences between the subspecies that can be observed, if not simply size. The Sumatran tiger is, of course, known to be one of the smallest of the tigers, and the Siberian tiger is considered to be the largest.
And on the site, I was looking at that the smallest tigers are somewhere in the 250 to 300-pound range, whereas the largest are more in the 600-pound range.
Right. We actually, at CIFAR, we have a number of cats that certainly fit the bill for both sizes, including some that are even smaller than that 200 to 250-pound range.
Oh, really? We actually have some tigers that are even smaller than the Sumatrans.
Smaller than the number for the Sumatrans. Giving a number
right.
That's a weight for a tiger is sort of like saying that a human weighs around 70 kilograms. It's just a myopic average.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But the other frightening fact was that in the last century, 97% of the tigers have disappeared, in the sense that we're at 3,200 now, but there was 97% more of them only 100 years ago.
At the turn of the 20th century, it was known that there were over 100,000 tigers alone in the wild. This number has dwindled significantly, not the least part due to hunting and due to a cultural influence that held the tiger to be a danger and a threat more than a natural resource. In the last part of the 20th century, throughout the 70s and the 80s, that's when we saw the end of three subspecies, the Javan, the Balinese, and the Caspian tiger. That was when they were formally declared extinct.
So how many species there? You just listed three.
Yes, at the time there were eight. So when those three went extinct, we only had five subspecies of tiger. Now we have six, and we have 3,200 left in the wild, which, while that number may sound dire, is actually a bit more positive than you might imagine.
Oh, really?
Indeed. In fact, as recently as 2006 or so, a lot of the conservation literature was saying that there would be no tigers in the wild after about 5 years. And obviously now it's 2014. We have progressed on by 8 years, and that number still hasn't changed. In fact, for the first time when I was looking at some of the conservation literature, I saw someone saying that it now looks like it would be at least 15 years before all the tigers would go extinct. While that sounds like a dire prediction, for the last several years, everyone has been thinking we've only got 5 years left to have tigers in the wild. Now that we're saying we have 15, that actually is a good sign in a strange, backwards kind of way.
Well, sure. It's progress, at least in the right direction.
At least the appearance of progress, certainly.
I guess you could say it that way, yes. The appearance of progress in the correct direction. Interestingly enough, one of the biggest threats for the tigers is poaching, which I'm sure most people would have guessed. But the reasons for the poaching is because the tiger parts are sought after for folk remedies and for status symbols.
Yes, and this has only been made worse by the advancement of some societies that previously couldn't afford such luxuries as tiger parts. When we look at societies, especially in traditional Chinese medicine, the tiger has always been a status symbol, but it's been a status symbol that was heretofore unattainable. Now, with their country growing at a rate of 7.5%, which is an incredible gross domestic product growth. They are having new wealth, and that new wealth is exercising its power in ways that are perhaps predictable, but somewhat unfortunate.
Well, unfortunate for the Tigers, at least.
It is. And this disparity is what makes the situation even more acute. Many people wonder about what the greatest threat is to tigers, and I don't believe that it's actually just poaching. It's not that simple. The greatest threat to tigers really is poverty.
Poverty, I see. That's a good point. And actually, that's one of the things that was discussed on the site, was specifically about poverty and the fact that saving the tigers can actually lead to other avenues for making a livelihood. Where there are tigers, there's going to be tourism, and there are other avenues for making money for the fact that the tigers are still there, as opposed to poaching them and selling them and to the point where there are no tigers left.
It's very simple economics. If you can create a demand, then you can deal with the issue of supply. Now, the supply of tigers is relatively limited, which, of course, creates a demand for them, either alive or for them dead. The trick of this conservation is to try and make sure that they are more valuable alive than they are dead. And that is a technique that has been extremely successful, not just for the tigers, but also for other big cats and other species around the world.
Thanks for listening to CIFAR Sounding. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, my name is Phyllis Park. I am the events coordinator for Central Florida Animal Reserve. Here are some of the events that we have coming up. The first event will be the Warbird Air Show in Titusville, Florida on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, March 14th, 15th, and 16th. The gates open at 8:30 a.m. and will run until about 5 p.m. Several of CIFAR staff members will be there introducing our organization to attendees from all over the world. It's quite a big show with several thousand people. Birthday, presented by WJRR. It's a rock music festival on April 12th. This is a Saturday. Gates opening at 11 a.m. at the Central Florida Fairgrounds. The event runs until around 11 p.m., but CIFAR staff will be there until around dark. We will be selling CIFAR merchandise and promoting our organization, soliciting new volunteers for our organization, since this will be fairly close to our new home. Sebastian will be there meeting old friends and making new friends. The next event that's coming up will be our Member Appreciation Day on May 18th, which is a Sunday from 12 until 5 p.m. This is an opportunity to meet the CIFAR staff, see the cats in their home, to ask all of your questions and see what's going on with our future as well as with the cats. We hope to see you at this upcoming event. Come out and see us. Thank you for supporting CIFAR.
Thanks, Phyllis. Enjoy this musical interlude. CIFAR Sounding will be right back. Simba Wiltz and Asla Kanser, talking about conservation.
Right, and the discussion that we started with was the idea of a tiger being a capstone species. And the idea of that is not just because we want to save the tiger for the sake of having tigers around. There's other reasons for saving the tiger. For one thing, when you take the effort to save even one tiger, you have to save 25,000 acres of land of natural habitat for them. And think of all the different other species and plants and animals that are living in that specific area that are also saved by the fact that you're saving that area for the tiger.
It's a good analogy that a tiger is sort of like the CEO of a food chain. If the company, if nature is running well, then the tiger, as the top of that food chain, will also be able to do well because the ecosystem is able to sustain everything from the plants that the insects thrive on, that the smaller predators thrive on, that birds and others thrive on, that go all the way up to the prey animals that tigers will directly eat, have to be healthy, and the systems have to be sound and robust all the way down those lines. And so
exactly. The tiger being there helps the ecosystem be healthy, which in turn has a direct effect on the residents, the human residents in that area, because they have the benefit of having plenty of plants and food life as well as clean water from a clean and healthy ecosystem.
Yes. The challenge is, of course, that humans are the only species that tends to change reality as opposed to work within the bounds of reality, especially when it comes to nature. If a food is not present for a tiger, then the tiger is going to leave that area and go in search of some other place that they will have food, whereas a human will instead create avenues whereby the food can either come to them or even go so far as to limit the ability of other species to eat so that they can self-sustain.
But the point of having the tiger be saved is that, of course, you're saving all these other species, plants, animals, as well as creating a healthy ecosystem whereby the human residents are able to receive clean water and also have plants and animals for their food. So clearly, it's in the best interest to save the tigers, not just for the tigers themselves, but to save the ecosystems to which they belong.
It is in the best interest for all the people to want to save the tigers. Now, unfortunately, there is some harsh reality that comes into play when it comes to saving the tigers. Tigers, with only 3,200 left in the world, they are limited to an extraordinarily small part of the planet. And it makes a very difficult argument to suggest that somehow saving the ecosystem of a single jungle that may be Ranthambore or someplace in India is going to have a positive effect for someone who's living in a flat in London or an apartment in LA. And so that really falls back into that discussion of why we have these capstone species and why they're so necessary. Because for the grand majority of people on the planet, tigers are never going to be part of their everyday life. They're never going to have that kind of direct relationship that is going to require them to keep the tigers around because it's part of vested self-interest. It really becomes a matter of trying to sell the tigers and sell their plight based upon what it represents for everyone, but also based upon just their sheer presence and beauty.
Well, of course, the tiger is as well revered as it is feared, and that in itself brings the beauty and the majesty and all of the different aspects of having such a majestic animal in the wild that intrigues people.
It does, and it's fascinating because neighbors such as India and China, for example, whereas India, the tiger is very much revered as a national symbol and is conserved, and actually the seat of tiger conservation in many cases is taking place in India. You have China, which takes a very different perspective, which sees the tiger more as a commodity and oftentimes still idolizes, still reveres, but will also use their parts to be part of traditional Chinese medicine, in spite of the fact that many practitioners have tried to move away from it.
But of course, the efforts to conserve the habitats for the tigers so that they are still there and that their ecosystems are still there do help the native peoples that are in those areas that need the clean water and food from those ecosystems. But I know that one of the other issues, of course, is as humans encroach on their land, the tigers will tend to attack domestic animals of farmers because it's the only food that's around. And of course, that causes another discourse where the humans now want to kill the tiger for killing their domestic animals. So I know that one of the techniques that I've heard about in the past is to actually create somewhat like an insurance policy for farmers that live near these lands to actually pay them for any animals that are killed by tigers or other species that are endangered.
Yes, and that technique has also been used in Africa when it comes to lion attacks on people's cattle. As far as when it comes to species that have interaction with humans, the lions and the tigers are two of the biggest culprits of taking livestock out from under farmers and those who are living agrarian lifestyles. The challenge, of course, being that in some of these societies, cattle, livestock, it's no different than if somebody went into your bank account and took out a wad of cash. These animals are representative of both wealth as well as power, and so for a natural force to come and take it away is a significant blow to them, to their family, especially in their cultural diaspora. So it becomes very important that systems are set up such that they can be compensated for any kind of tiger slash lion attack and make sure that they have a chance to save the lion from or tiger from being killed simply out of economics.
Absolutely. The economics is what it comes down to when we get to the very bottom of the whole subject is the economics makes all the difference. It's why the poachers are poaching the tigers. They need the money that the tigers can bring by selling their parts. It's why the farmers are killing the tigers, because the tigers are eating their livestock, which is, of course, to them, money. It's all economics.
It is, at least in our species, it certainly is just economics. And so we have to make it such that they're more valuable alive than they would be dead.
Absolutely. Interesting. I want to talk a little bit about also the way in which a tiger, you've talked about that if saving one tiger, you need to save 25,000 acres of land and habitat for them. But that in and of itself, why is it that having the tiger there makes the ecosystem more healthy? And if you look at it from a kind of a small circle of life perspective, the tigers are eating the deer and other types of ungulates that are running around in that habitat. Those deer are eating plants and such that are in that habitat. All of those things have to be in check so that if you have too many deer, they're going to starve each other out by not having enough food in the habitat. So the tigers help thin that population to a more healthy level for the ecosystem. The other part of that is if you have too many deer and they're eating all the plants, there's less plants to actually clean the nutrients and clean the soils to give them more plantable soils for the humans, but also to clean the waters that are running through those soils so that you have clean water. That's kind of a top view overall look at how the circle of life makes a big difference in an ecosystem and why the tiger needs to be there.
It is, and I'm sure that there are researchers out there who have taken the academic route and gone into extraordinary detail of how each small impact on the environment eventually rolls up as well as rolls down the food web that has been discussed over the course of time. It's just
We have so many examples of that, even in the U.S. The one big one that comes to mind, something small that you wouldn't think of, is the whole Dust Bowl that happened to us. You know, in the Midwest, they chopped down all the trees to plant all the farms. But, of course, those tree roots were holding all the soil in place. So when we had some bad storms and big winds, the soil blew away. And we actually had what was called the Dust Bowl for so long and lost a lot of natural habitat as well as habitat for growing plants.
There's no state that is more impacted than the state of Florida when it comes to people thinking that they understand the ecosystem and finding out that they're not so good at manipulating it. We have a lot of invasive species that have taken over our state, both from a plant standpoint as well as from an animal standpoint.
Yeah, I think maybe over the course of the next few shows, we might try to feature a few of those and talk a little bit about them, because I think people would be surprised as to how many of those situations actually exist right here in Florida. The first one I just to mention real quick is the one that everybody hears about in the news are the snakes in the Everglades.
The pythons in the Everglades, of course.
Yeah, they don't belong in Florida, obviously. And they're clearly brought there by humans dropping them off in the Everglades. You know, Johnny wanted a snake for Christmas, got a snake, got too big, and they dropped them off in the Everglades. Well, now they're breeding, and there's so many of them that they're eating everything in sight. The ecosystem in the Everglades is suffering deeply from it. And that's just one of the things that's happening here in Florida. And that is one of the ones that probably most people know about because it's in the news a lot because, you know, snakes are kind of the anti-capstone species.
Yes, snakes are, as well as a lot of spiders, which is another big problem that they've got now in the Everglades where they've got a living tarantula population.
That's right. Oh, that's just wonderful, isn't it? I was listening to a show recently that was talking about the fact that what people take as pets goes in cycles, and there's fads that are things that are big for a while and times when they're not. And a few years ago, the tarantula thing was just such a big fad. Everybody wanted a tarantula. Everybody's kid wanted a tarantula. Well, they're not all that, well, they might be fuzzy, but they're not all that warm and cuddly, that's for sure. So who knows how many of those tarantulas ended up just all over the place that they don't belong.
Yes, it's an arachnophobe's nightmare.
That's true. That's true. But, yeah, I think maybe we should try to bring up some of those kind of stories over the next few weeks to try to highlight some of those kinds of things. Because clearly, when we talk about the tigers and Central Florida Animal Reserve, it isn't just about the tigers that are living amongst our walls there in our enclosures. It's about conservation in general and about the environment in general.
It is. And it's important to recognize that at some point along the line, the conservation razor that we walk is going to break in one direction or another. We are either going to find a way to preserve and to save and maintain the tiger population, which can grow their numbers and give them a chance to live life wild, strong, and free the way that they had at the turn of the 20th century. Or we're going to fail in this endeavor. And the only place that people are going to be able to engage these species are going to be in captive environments. And either way, there is a major role that we're playing right now with the work that we're doing at CIFAR. We are either going to have to learn how to live together in harmony, which means learning their habits, which means learning how to take care of them and what they need in order to survive, or we're going to have to learn how to be better stewards, because we will be their only bastion of safety in the world. And either way, we're well positioned to do both of them.
And actually, there's another point to bring up about CIFAR and being in Central Florida. There are a lot of tigers in the state of Florida. Now, they're all in captivity. But how many are there in the state of Florida? Do you happen to know? I think you'd said that there's more in the state of Florida than anywhere else in the U.S., though.
The answer to that is maybe. And we do know that there are a lot of cats in captivity. And with only 3,200 cats in the entire world that are considered wild, I would venture to say that there are more cats in captivity than there are left in the wild, even though there have been some studies that have suggested otherwise. At least from a worldwide standpoint, I would believe that. When it comes to Florida, we know that we have over 100 facilities that are licensed to handle and maintain tigers as Class 1 animals. Now, those 100 facilities may have one, or in the case of, say, for us, we have 33 big cats. Not all of them are going to be as, 33 tigers specifically. We have 33 tigers, and not all of them are going to be as large as CIFAR. So there are probably at least 1,000 tigers that could be in the state of Florida. We really don't know. It could be a much smaller number. But the states that are often looked at in terms of tiger ownership being large are states like Texas, Nevada, North Carolina, states that heretofore have not chosen to enact laws for the care and handling of big cats on a statewide level. We're going to continue this discussion on conservation next week. You've been listening to CIFAR Sounding with Asla Gonzer and Simba Wiltz. CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve, where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment. At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision. Learn more about us on our website and send us comments through our email, contact@cflar.org. For Asla Gonzer, I'm Simba Wiltz. We'll be back next week with more CIFAR Sounding.